From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Bill Cosby and Roman Polanski are out of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Then he wrote West Side Story's music, led the New York Philharmonic, and was tracked by the FBI. A new exhibit celebrates the life and work of Leonard Bernstein.
He was a composer. He was a conductor. He was a great pianist. He was a fantastic ambassador for American classical music, all rolled into one. He was a rock star, pure and simple.
And what do Elvis, Johnny Cash, and Rufus Thomas have in common? One author's take on Memphis's musical legacy. All that coming right up. We begin today with the news that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has voted to expel actor Bill Cosby and director Roman Polanski from its membership. Last week, Bill Cosby was found guilty of aggravated indecent assault for an incident in 2004, but Roman Polanski's case dates back to 1977, when he pled guilty to unlawful sex with a minor, a 13-year-old girl. Polanski served 42 days in prison but fled the country before his sentencing. So why did the Academy make its decision now? To talk about the Academy's decision and its timing, I called up Rebecca Keegan. She's a Hollywood correspondent for Vanity Fair.
The timing really stems from October, when the Academy board voted to expel Harvey Weinstein. And that was unusually swift for the Academy. Normally, this organization, as you know well, takes a long time to sort of respond to events like this in the news. And it kind of signaled that the Academy was speeding up its process in a lot of ways. Once the Harvey Weinstein expulsion happened, people started to ask questions of other high-profile members who had sort of stories like this about them or legal issues, which included, of course, Bill Cosby and Roman Polanski.
It's also the case, too, that the Academy has been revising its code of conduct. And I talked to an Academy governor, and the story that I'm hearing is that the code of conduct really kind of caught up to these individuals as opposed to the other way around. That as the Academy started to reconsider what was and was not acceptable behavior, what Roman Polanski and Bill Cosby did clearly fell outside of that realm and was considered grounds for kicking them out.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, the code of conduct has not been without controversy. There are some high-profile Academy members, including Bill Mechanic, a governor who stepped down recently, a producer who feels like this isn't the Academy's place to pass a code of conduct, that it's for the movie studios or production companies or for law enforcement to deal with these issues. Clearly, the majority of the Board of Governors disagrees with that, and it sounds like the governor that you spoke with may have disagreed with that. And they feel that it is appropriate for the Academy to not only have a code of conduct, but to enforce it in cases of clear violations like Cosby and Polanski.
I think the other thing that's materially important here is that the composition of the Board of Governors is radically different than it was 10, 15 years ago, that now there are women in prominent positions in the Academy, and I think more than a quarter of the governors right now are women, which certainly was not the case in very recent memory.
Right. I mean, you know, probably one of the most prominent governors is Kathleen Kennedy, the head of Lucasfilm, who has also been sort of spearheading this issue of the industry dealing with sexual harassment in general. So she's sort of probably a strong voice on the board. Other prominent women on the board include Whoopi Goldberg, the head of Fox Searchlight, Nancy Utley, Christina Cornelius from Participant. There are a lot of, you know, sort of high-profile women in the industry who are present. It's also, the board has also just gotten bigger in general, and it's a lot more people who are having a say into these discussions. There has been, as far as I can tell, not entire agreement on this issue in the board. So while there may be more women on the board, there are more people of color on the board, there is also more, I think, intense debate surrounding some of these hot-button topics.
Yeah, I think we don't know right now what the vote was inside the boardroom, but what does it actually mean when you are expelled from the Academy? What are the consequences of that?
Well, you lose your voting rights. So Roman Polanski and Bill Cosby, if they had been active voters, will not be any longer. I don't know that those are two people who cared much about being invited to screenings, but they won't be invited to screenings any longer. They won't get their screeners. I think this is probably more important for Roman Polanski, who is still actively making films and is still sort of engaged in the entertainment community, at least in Europe.
Let me ask you this last question. How important do you think it is to the Academy that it takes a leadership position on this issue, that even if it isn't deciding who's getting hired to make movies, it can be in a leadership position about what is and is not acceptable behavior?
You know, this is something that I think about a lot. What is the Academy's role here? I think as an organization, there's some debate about that. But to the extent that the Academy represents how the film industry sort of portrays itself to the world, how it's perceived to the world, to the extent that it represents sort of excellence in cinema, it's clear that they had to look at this sort of egregious issue in their industry and figure out a response to it. Now, the sort of individual ways in which they're handling cases, you may sort of take issue with, but the idea that the Academy could just sort of ignore this or let other people deal with it, I don't think that works in 2018.
Yeah, and I think the next question is what happens to those individuals, and I'm thinking now of people like Kevin Spacey, Casey Affleck, who have not been charged criminally but have been accused of sexual assault and harassment. I don't know what the Academy's position is on them, but I suspect that as times change, we may have more people who are asked to leave the Academy.
Yeah, I mean, this is the sort of dilemma that the Academy has created for itself is, prior to this, prior to Harvey Weinstein, the only example of someone being asked to leave the Academy was a guy who shared his screeners. Now that you have a code of conduct, you do raise a question for every member of the Academy of what they've done over the course of their often long careers, and you know, sort of who they've offended or hurt. It becomes a lot more complicated, and it does, I think, create an issue where there's a lot of gray area for the Academy to have to now start looking into.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting, too, that Harvey Weinstein, even though he has been accused of a wide array of bad behavior and potentially criminal behavior, he has not been convicted or tried in anything yet. Rebecca Keegan is a Hollywood correspondent for Vanity Fair. She is also the On the Lot guest on our sister show, Take Two. Rebecca, thanks for coming on The Frame.
Thanks, Sean.
Leonard Bernstein was born 100 years ago this August. He was a composer, a conductor, and an educator. And even though he worked largely in classical music, Bernstein's popularity was remarkably broad. His compositions for orchestras and in musical theater, especially his percussive work on West Side Story, still sound thoroughly modern decades after they were written. Bernstein came of age at a time when major symphonies in the U.S. were not actually led by Americans. When he became principal conductor and music director of the New York Philharmonic, he changed that history. Leonard Bernstein died in 1990, and an exhibit celebrating his legacy has just opened at the Skirball Cultural Center. I toured the multimedia installation with curator Robert Santelli, who is also the founding executive director of the Grammy Museum in downtown Los Angeles.
So, Bob, we walk into the gallery and we see a baton and a picture of a very young Leonard Bernstein. So what is it about Bernstein's story that you think is so remarkable?
Leonard Bernstein was an exceedingly complex individual, both artistically and personally. He was a composer. He was a conductor. He was a great pianist. He was a fantastic ambassador for American classical music, all rolled into one. He was a rock star, pure and simple. He had Hollywood looks. He had a charisma and sense about himself that was just magnetic. And then, of course, from a professional point of view, what he has contributed to the American classical music treasury is just it's just astounding. I don't think there is another American classical music figure more important than Leonard Bernstein.
When he was a young boy, I think it's fair to say his parents maybe didn't feel strongly in his pursuing a career in music.
and I see a piano over there, and I know there was a piano teacher early in Leonard Bernstein's life. Should we walk over to this piano?
So this piano here is actually on loan from Brandeis University in Massachusetts. It is the piano that Leonard Bernstein learned how to play piano, and really not just learned how to play piano, but grew to love the idea of self-expression in music. There are two pianos in here, one his first and the other one a baby grand that's one of the last pianos that he played. So we kind of see them more or less as exhibit bookends, if you will.
I think people of a certain generation, and I'm not going to say my age, I'm not going to ask you yours, remember Leonard Bernstein from his educational work, especially on television.
I mean, if a melody is simply one note coming after another, how can a composer avoid writing melodies if he just writes notes? He must write melodies all the time. For example, he writes one note, then he writes another.
The Young People's Concerts, this is where Bernstein the ambassador, Bernstein the teacher, really shines. So we have original footage from the Young People's Concerts. We also have Bernstein, if you will, lecturing or explaining the art of conducting. And, you know, the art of conducting for many people is a mystery.
The concept of precision, as symbolized by this wooden stick we call the baton. Mendelssohn dedicated himself to an exact realization of the score he was conducting through manipulation of this baton.
Most of the prominent conductors in America at the time, especially pre-World War II, were European-trained and European in origin. Bernstein breaks that mold, and it allows many others to follow. His influence is so strong that it's not just in America. Case in point, our own Gustavo Dudamel here in Los Angeles. Huge influence Bernstein was on him. And we have a very interesting artifact that I'd like to show you next that demonstrates his enthusiasm and connection to Bernstein.
So this is a case, and in it is a broken baton.
So Leonard Bernstein had many batons, many of which were in the possession of the New York Philharmonic Archives. Dudamel comes to town and asks, basically, if he could conduct with one. Now, if you know anything about Dudamel's conducting, he's very passionate, very physical. So was Leonard Bernstein. So Dudamel basically conducts and breaks the baton and is horrified by it. So in the exhibit, not only do we have the broken baton, but we also have an explanation by Dudamel himself explaining exactly what happened. Of course, I think Bernstein would have been overly happy with the idea that he broke it, because it meant that the enthusiasm and the passion for what he was doing was evidence in the actual breaking of the baton, not unlike Bernstein would have done in his prime as well.
Three upbeats, which is what the piece is about. As in the beginning, the symphony was about da-da-da-da, not da-da-da-da, which we all heard as kids, right? You see what I mean? No.
Is there a feeling that he couldn't be out as a gay man, and one of the reasons he might have been married is because he couldn't get work if he was known to be gay?
You know, I think that, of course, was a very different time than today. And if he actually came out and announced his homosexuality, I think that would have, his career would have been suffered in some parts. But he, you know, many people around him were gay as well. And he handled that with a discretion that allowed him to move forward. But yet at the same time, he carried on relationships with men, and it did it in a discreet way. I think he was very much in love with his wife, and he was very much dedicated to being a father. But this is where that complexity comes in. I'm not a psychologist or someone who could even dare to predict exactly how he did things and why. We just know that he handled it, and he did it with as much discretion and respect as he possibly could. But in the end, there were conflicts, and both personal and professional, and there's just no way to get around that, and that's part of the overall Bernstein story.
Leonard Bernstein is probably best known for a piece of Broadway music that he wrote. Is there a West Side Story wing we should go walk to?
Yes, there is.
So West Side Story was really the apex of his career, the first phase of it, and a very important moment in 1957. So what you'll see is a number of things. In addition to scores, you'll also see, for instance, the desk from which Leonard Bernstein wrote West Side Story. You'll also be able to go into a singing booth and pretend that you're part of the cast and sing along with America.
A small fee in America.
Okay. Oh, buying on credit is so nice.
One look at us and they charge twice.
I have my own washing machine.
What will you have though to keep clean?
You picked America because, well, when you talk about themes, that song is absolutely perfect for what's happening today with our whole immigration issues. And so we love for young people to go in, never heard the song, but it's so catchy, so good, that if you go in there, you'll become part of the cast, if only for a minute or two.
I'll get a terrace apartment.
Better get rid of your accent.
Life can be bright in America.
If you can fight in America.
Life is all right in America.
If you're all white in America.
I want to ask you a little bit more about Leonard Bernstein's work as a political activist, what he considered important, what his causes were, because he was certainly very active during the Vietnam War. And it looks like you have some sort of collections of, like, I think those are probably FBI. His part of his FBI dossier. How did you come upon that? I suspect they didn't give it to you.
We didn't use the Freedom of Information Act. We didn't go to the FBI. Basically, we got it from the family. It's many, many pages, and we show a few of them just to give you the extent as to the kinds of things that the FBI were interested in Bernstein. But here's the thing with Bernstein. You know, he comes of age as a young man at Harvard in the 1930s and becomes very much exposed to radical and new ideas, socialist ideas, even the flirt with some communists as well. But he sees the common man as a individual in America who has been exploited and needs help. So he gets involved in liberal causes, not just in the 30s, but all throughout his life. He was a big proponent of Israel as the country of Israel in 48 begins to assert itself. He makes numerous trips over there to celebrate the music. Of course, Bernstein being Jewish, he had a deep connection to it. He helps the orchestra and symphonies over there to get started. But then as we move into the 60s, he becomes someone who is definitely against the Vietnam War. He is for civil rights, and he actually hosts a party, a very famous party that the writer Tom Wolfe writes about, in which he hosts Black Panthers from Harlem and New York, socializing and integrating with some of the most liberal elite of New York City. It must have been a trip. But he continues causes. And today, I suspect, if he were alive, he would be deeply involved in all the major movements that are surfacing in our time today.
Bob, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Leonard Bernstein at 100 is at the Skirball Cultural Center through September 2nd. And you can see photos of that conducting baton that Dudamel broke and pages from Bernstein's FBI file at theframe.org. Coming up, we explore the sounds of Memphis blues. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Nashville and Memphis are only a couple hundred miles apart, and yet the two Tennessee cities couldn't be more different, especially when it comes to music. In the 1950s and 60s, Nashville churned out smooth, commercial-oriented country hits, while Memphis embraced an edgier sound. Thanks Sun Records, Sam Phillips' label, which introduced Elvis Presley and Johnny Cash, and Stax Records with its many soul influencers like Isaac Hayes and Rufus Thomas. Memphis-based author and filmmaker Robert Gordon captures the grit of his hometown in his new book, Memphis Rent Party, from Sam Phillips' crazed appearance on David Letterman's show to encounters with impoverished bluesmen in rural juke joints. When Gordon spoke with The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett, he began with a moment that he first fell in love with Memphis music.
I guess the real big incident was going to a Rolling Stones concert when I was 14, outdoors, summer, hot as blazes, all-day affair, and the three warm-up bands were done at like 4:30, and the Stones were like, we're not getting on that stage till the sun goes down. And they sent across town and brought this blues guitarist to fill some time. I remember my back was to the stage, and I was looking for my friend who'd gone off to get us some Coca-Cola like 2 hours earlier.
I've been worried all night long.
I heard this craggy voice and this sound of a guy on an acoustic guitar, and I turned around and I was like, what is that?
When I worry so hard, I know that it ain't gonna be long.
I was totally smitten by Furry Lewis's performance, and I think I knew at that point that the blues were from Memphis, that, you know, we were the home of the blues, but I didn't realize until then that the old cats were still alive. And about a year later, Furry Lewis, now in my mind the opening act for the Rolling Stones, appeared on the porch at my high school during lunchtime, and an upperclassman gave me Furry's phone number and said, call him up, he'll invite you over. I did, he did. This tells you a lot about Memphis in the mid-1970s. It was easier for me as a 15-year-old to buy the pint of whiskey Furry wanted than it was for me to find a ride to that part of town.
I know one thing, I can play better here tonight. I went to another place other night and I couldn't play so good. They had me in the dark, it was so dark there, I struck a match, had to strike another and see what's that and burning. And I'm going to Brown, Vermont, take that right-hand road.
Everything was different at Furry's house. Furry's place was so impoverished. You know, I was from solidly middle class, tending toward upper middle class. So in terms of a career, what I realized happened there was that I connected the blues with the social circumstance. And I realized early on that paying with publicity was not paying. Paying with publicity was thieving. And I have had hard arguments with people about this, but I believe in paying for interviews. These guys give me their time. I'm creating an article that I'm getting paid for, and they've got heating bills.
I'm gonna write me a letter, gonna mail it in the air.
I've gotten turned on to some of my favorite music by attending civic music festivals. And at one festival, I heard this blues band that was great, and I hollered down, hey, where do y'all play? And the guy told me, and I found it on a map, and the band's name was the Fieldstones.
Talking about the Fieldstones, yeah.
They had a home in a club called Green's Lounge, and it was like a double shotgun cinder block building. There was a bar on one side and seating on the other, and the band, I mean, it was just so small and intimate. So smoky. People in California today would freak out walking into that place.
Talking about the Fieldstones, yeah. The Fieldstones.
They were a great band because they ruled the dance floor. I mean, that was a place you could go dance from the first song on the first set to the last song on the last set. The band had recorded an album at one point for the University of Memphis's record label called High Water. And one day they said, we have a second album in the can. I was like, oh, excellent, can't wait. And it turned out it was like 20 years before it came out. And so I'll read you the end of the Fieldstones piece. The years have not been kind to the Fieldstones. Making this music was not glamorous. The last time I saw Lois, the bass player, her health was failing seriously. I heard she lost a leg to diabetes. Joe Hicks, the drummer, had a series of light strokes. Clarence, the guitarist, died. Wordy sobered up and, I think, works in a factory. Last time I dropped Tony off at her place in the projects, she borrowed $15 and has been hiding from me ever since. Evelyn Young passed away Applewhite has had serious kidney trouble. After Green's Lounge shut down in the mid-1990s, Wilroy purchased it and ran it with his wife, Dorothy. That's when a fire shuttered it. I've waited nearly 20 years to hear this album. Now that we've got it, here's my suggestion. Get one 40-watt light, maybe two. You'll need either a smoke machine or a convenience store's worth of burning cigarettes. Definitely a cooler full of beer quarts, and also setups. A maraschino cherry on top of a hotel ice bucket, napkins stuffed inside tiny drinking glasses. Find a real diverse group of human beings. Large, small, very fat, quite skinny, black, white, and others. Put a sign on the wall that says, "No dope smoking," then ignore it. Hire a skinny man you could push over with a sneeze, give him a loaded gun, and let him frisk everyone as they enter. Turn up Mud Island Blues. Dance.
I don't claim to be bad people.
And that is it for today. You can keep up with The Frame on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can find me at JG Horn. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
I mean-